I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Just recently, I returned from grizzly bear country, and I'm very pleased to report that I did not have to use my bear spray. Very sad to report that I never saw a grizzly. Nor did I see a pizzly. I wasn't far enough north, apparently. A pizzly bear, that is to say, is a growler bear. Am I helping you any? Pizzlies are growlers. Growlers are pizzlies, just two different names for a hybrid animal that results from the crossing of polars and grizzlies. Is the future of the Arctic region going to include more and more of these hybrids? We're going to consider the question with Larissa DeSantis. She's an associate professor of biological sciences at Vanderbilt University. She's on the line with us. Larissa DeSantis, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
The burning question is, how close have you been to one of these creatures? They're rare. I would imagine it's kind of hard to find one.
Yeah, I actually choose to study these animals from the safety of museum collections. So I'm actually a paleontologist by training. And so I study things and try to understand and recreate sort of the behavior of animals in the past. And just recently, we wanted to understand what was happening with some more modern animals today. You know, how have the diets of polar bears changed over time? Or, how can we better understand the diets of grizzly bears, for example? And in a world in which climate change is happening, we really want to know what these impacts are.
So I said rare. Is there any kind of a census? Is there a count?
They are extremely rare. And so the only reason we actually know about a pizzly one was shot in the wild. And so back in about 2006, Jim Martell, he was a hunter from Idaho, actually shot one of these polar bears on the Banks Islands in Canada. And the Banks Islands are a little bit bigger than West Virginia, but have a very small population of native people who live there. And it was through further DNA testing that they were actually able to demonstrate that this individual, this bear that was shot, that looked like a polar bear in some ways, but also looked a little bit like a grizzly bear in some ways, actually was in fact a pizzly or a growler bear. It had a polar bear mother and a grizzly bear father. And since then, there have been a few other occurrences in the wild where there have been instances of pizzlies or even pizzlies have reproduced with grizzlies and produced offspring, which have been subsequently examined and documented as occurring in the wild. And also there have been occurrences of pizzlies in captivity, and they have also been studied at particular zoos. And that's really interesting, which I hope we get to talk about as well.
Yeah. You mean in a zoo? This would all happen in a zoo?
So there was an occurrence of a pizzly cubs, a male and female cub that were born in captivity. What they did is they immediately removed those two cubs from the polar bear mother, and they were raised at another zoo. And subsequently, they actually studied these pizzlies to understand sort of their phenotype, what they looked like, and also their behavior. And so it was one of these rare opportunities to see, you know, is a pizzly better at swimming than a grizzly? And the answer was yes, right? So a pizzly is better able to survive or better able to swim than a grizzly, and it's not as good of a swimmer as a polar bear. And there were other features they were curious about and other behaviors, like how did it actually interact with different objects? Did it sort of pounce on them? Did it sort of, when it lied down, how did it lie? And also, what did it look like as far as coloration and body form and all of those different features? And so they were actually able to sort of better understand what these pizzlies were in a environment in which they could get sort of very close to these living animals and learn about their behaviors.
Well, now that you've mentioned what they look like, let's go there. What do they look like?
So they are what you would expect if you had a polar bear mother and a grizzly bear father. They are intermediate between the two. And so coloration is intermediate. You'll often find they're not as white as the polar bear. They have a much lighter coloration than grizzly bears and are intermediate in that form. The other ways in which they're intermediate are having sort of a skull that's not as elongated as the polar bear. So the polar bear is highly specialized on being able to hunt seals from sea ice. And so even though they are closely related to grizzly bears, they diverged some time ago, about 500,000 years ago. And one of the things that we've noticed about polar bears is they have these elongated skulls. And those skulls are really useful for, again, hunting these seals from sea ice. And that is really a very specific adaptation for that behavior. Grizzlies, on the other hand, actually have a bit sort of more, have shorter skulls, and they're able to have much higher bite forces. So what you're giving up in having a longer skull, you're getting by being able to sort of reach into these little holes in which they can sort of get at the seals when they come up to breathe. Whereas in the case of the grizzly bears, they actually have this more intermediate sort of features. And so some of our research has looked at, in a sense, what polar bear diets were doing over time. And so one of the questions we wanted to know is, you know, polar bears, essentially, they're highly specialized on eating these seals from sea ice. And are they now becoming more desperate? Are they eating sort of a broader array of things? We know that there has been observations of them eating seabird eggs. Are they now eating from carcasses and having to scavenge? What are they actually doing? And so one of the ways that we can do this is we can study polar bears from the safety of museum collections and actually take molds of their teeth. So essentially do a little bit of dentistry. And from that dentistry, we can reconstruct sort of the textures of the foods that they ate. And when we do this, one of the things that we find is that polar bears eat soft things. And we sort of knew this from observational data. We knew that they really prefer blubber. And in some cases, a really healthy polar bear will even leave some of the meat and the flesh behind of seals and really just concentrate on that blubber that has lots of fat so that it can also maintain a high amount of fat in its body for various, you know, metabolic reasons. And it's very cold. You have to be able to maintain that body heat, et cetera. And so they will eat lots of, you know, very soft things. So essentially, you know, one of the things that I noticed being a paleontologist is that, you know, their teeth for this very large bear, their molars are actually a little bit smaller than grizzly bear molars. And yet they have these massive canines. So they're really well suited for sort of taking down something with, you know, the seals, for example, from the sea ice with those canines, but they're used to eating really soft things. They're eating essentially blubber or jello all of the time.
Blubber or jello, you say?
or a jello-like substance, exactly.
So they're going to bite into the seal material. They're going to prefer the softer tissues or fat, I should say. And then they don't need to chew it much because it just slurps right down.
Exactly, right? So they're actually not really having lots of wear and tear on their teeth. And that's exactly what we were seeing. And one other thing that we found when we sort of study these bears is that it was some of the largest bears that actually were eating slightly harder foods. And so you did see a little bit of this relationship with the biggest bears able to eat sort of a broader array of things. And so this sort of gave us indication that there was sort of a biomechanical constraint. There was that the elongated shape of the skull was actually limiting the polar bear's ability to eat really hard foods. And this is exactly the opposite of what you see in a grizzly bear. Grizzly bears have a shorter skull. They're able to eat really hard things. They can eat tubers. They can eat various seeds and acorns. They eat lots of fish and are really the ultimate generalist. Everything from grass to even, you know, carcasses of ungulates, of hooved animals. Grizzlies will eat pretty much everything. And they're really well suited to being able to eat all these different food sources, but the polar bears aren't. And we actually do see evidence that, you know, they're just these soft food feeders over time. So even with the warming that's been happening, they really haven't been able to sort of shift their diet or change their diet until the most recent time period, in which we are seeing a little bit of a shift away from these soft foods, which may be particularly problematic if they can't actually effectively sort of eat enough calories or eat enough of these foods to maintain their body size.
Well, you used the word problematic, and I think you were being a little bit euphemistic. I would think that this is catastrophic. If your food source goes – well, let's just put it this way. If you're a specialist – I think you've used the term hyper-specialization. If you're really focused on a certain food source and your entire biological history of your ancestors goes back to this is what we're going to eat and we're going to eat this almost exclusively and that goes away, you've got a catastrophe.
Absolutely. So specialists, the reason we see specialists occurring in nature is because they're really good at what they're doing. So, you know, let's think of something completely different for a moment. Let's think of, say, saber-toothed cats, right? A saber-toothed cat, one of my favorite prehistoric animals, has these really elongated teeth. Well, you could imagine that in the case of these saber-toothed cats, as you have slightly longer teeth and you're able to basically cause your prey to die quicker and to bleed out quicker, that you're going to be more effective at hunting those prey. And so there's going to be pretty rapid selection for that particular feature. Or in the case of an herbivore, let's take horses, for example. Horses used to actually have very short teeth. And over time, we actually see two things happening in horses, which is pretty interesting. We see elongated teeth, so taller teeth, and they also are able to become sort of more cursorial. They're able to run in a direction for longer. So think of horses as the size of your golden retriever, let's say, back in the past in sort of the Eocene. And then much more recently, we have horses that are much larger. And we see selection for those features, for example, that specialization when they start eating grass, right? They're able to eat grass. The more grass you can eat, the grass actually will wear down your teeth. And so horses are able to essentially eat more of this grass. Well, you wonder, okay, why are they then also getting bigger? And why are they able to sort of run faster? Well, as I often mention to students in my class, I don't necessarily need to outrun, you know, particular predator. I just need to outrun the other horse next to me. And so, in fact, the horses that are able to run faster and escape predation and have slightly taller teeth and eat more grass are able to then sort of live in these particular ecosystems and are really well established at being, you know, sort of these hyper specialists, these grazers, and can do that. And we see the same sort of thing happening in polar bears. So polar bears have, you know, they spend most of their time on the sea ice, and essentially they've learned that the seals will, you know, they have to come up for air. And so when these different sort of, they'll actually kind of stay and wait by these holes in the ice for the seals to come up, at which case they will sort of pounce and acquire that prey. So they become really, really good at doing what they're doing, which is excellent if that prey continues or things continue in the same direction. But essentially what we're seeing is the complete opposite. We're seeing dramatic climate change that's happening and affecting these polar bears. And so other things that are more generalists or opportunists. So for example, things like grizzly bears, they're probably going to do much better than say polar bears in response to climate change. We already see that they're moving further north. They're moving, sort of changing their ranges. They're able to eat a whole variety of different food sources. And so essentially if one type of prey goes away, they can eat something else. Or if berries go away, they can eat more salmon. For example. And so they have more options than a polar bear does.
Yeah. I want to go back just a bit. You were talking about how fast those horses can run. This is a new word for me. Did you say cursorial?
Yes. That means sort of ability to run in one direction pretty fast.
Yeah, it's a terrific word. I like it. We're going to take a short break and we're going to talk more about pizzlies and the chances of them perpetuating their kind. Will they reproduce? Will they establish themselves in the northern climes? Will they become a real thing and not just a rare thing? We'll talk about it in just a minute with Larissa DeSantis here on Constant Wonder. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. We've been talking about pizzly bears. Some people call them growler bears. A hybrid, a cross between a polar bear and a grizzly. And apparently it's a thing, kind of like the liger. You may have heard of ligers before. But what about, well, I'm going to say mules now, because Larissa DeSantis, I had thought that, you know, you get a cross and then you get a sterile creature often.
Yes. You're absolutely correct. That happens a lot. And typically, we don't expect hybrids to sort of be better adapted to their environment than either of its parent species. We actually expect them to be less well adapted. And this is because if you are a polar bear, you're really well suited for that environment. If you are a grizzly bear, you're really well suited for that environment. And so not only is it rare to have fertile hybrids for those offspring to actually be able to produce other offspring, but also we can also find that they're often maladapted. They're not well adapted to that environment. But this may sort of go out the window when we're thinking about a world in which we're getting sort of a warming environment where grizzlies may be having a few other adaptations and being a little bit more polar bear-like, maybe better swimmers, for example, or able to eat a variety of foods more like the grizzly bear than the polar bear, that you might see, you know, Pizzly's doing fairly well. But again, we normally expect hybrids to not do very well. And that's because, again, their parents are much better sort of well-suited for those particular environments than this sort of combination is. But again, these things change.
Yeah. Well, if you say well-suited for a particular environment, are you also talking maybe about well-suited for an environment that includes the competitors of grizzlies on the one side and polar bears on the other? I mean, you're fighting against your own cousins.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, one of sort of my fears with the polar bear is that as they're unable to effectively hunt these seals and they need to look for other types of foods, that they are just unable to both meet that caloric requirement. They're unable to just eat enough food, and they're also unable to sort of eat certain types of food. So for example, we know that they're not eating particularly hard things. And so if they're not able to eat tubers or scavenge on bowhead whale carcasses, for example, or if these aren't effective ways for them to acquire these calories, then there really is sort of a concern with these polar bears. Now, if polar bears and grizzlies continue to sort of come together, there is a possibility that those hybrids may be better suited than the polar bear to this changing and warming world. Now, that obviously is a big if, right? It requires lots of study. There are so few of these Pizzlies out there to begin with. Really, there's a lot of work that needs to go into understanding, you know, are they better adapted than the polar bear? But one thing I do fear is the polar bear going extinct because of this warming world. And what we know about most ecosystems across the globe is that they are the most stable if you have these apex predators. So apex predators, whether you like them or not, having mountain lions, having grizzlies, having wolves, having these large predators, lions, et cetera, in your ecosystem can have a stabilizing effect on the rest of the ecosystem. And this is a major reason why wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, is because they were able to prevent the elk from sort of eating too much of the vegetation and having sort of negative interactions on that environment. So for example, I live in Tennessee. We don't have wolves. We just recently have seen a few mountain lions that have started to pop back up into this region. Our largest predator are things like coyotes. And so deer populations are really out of control. They're really allowed to sort of reach very high levels, and they're, you know, often causing issues with human wildlife conflicts as far as people getting hit by deer in car accidents, for example. And so there can be sort of downstream impacts when an ecosystem is less stable. And that often occurs when you don't have sort of an apex predator in that ecosystem.
Well, I want to go way back in history, given the fact that I happen to be speaking with a paleontologist. We've got different kinds of bears that have disappeared over time, too. It's not just black bears, grizzlies, polars, and whatever that ferocious bear is in India. You've got extinct species of bear.
Yes, absolutely. And there was a giant short-faced bear that lived in North America called Arctotis cimus. And this was it would make any grizzly or any polar bear look small in comparison. So when it was standing on two legs, it would probably be about 11 or 12 feet tall. And at the shoulders would probably be about 5 to 6 feet tall. And so quite a massive animal. Now, the question is, was it a predator or not? And so what people have long been trying to understand, and bears are just so sort of difficult to study because bears do everything, right? So bears today, you have everything from an herbivorous bear that evolved from a carnivorous group. So the panda bear, where they're now eating, you know, primarily bamboo. But then you have other bears that are much more omnivorous, and the polar bear, which is hypercarnivorous, focusing just on meat and blubber of prey, for example. But a lot of bears, it's not quite clear sort of what they were doing, and it's particularly difficult to study in the fossil record. So often I study things like saber-toothed cats or dogs, Canis diuris, the dire wolf, and those are much easier to study. Saber-toothed cats were able to know whether, you know, we know that they're eating lots of meat, and so when they, for example, have certain isotopes in their teeth, or they have certain microscopic wear patterns on their teeth from chewing different things, we can tell whether they're eating flesh or bone. Now, in the case of bears, they eat such a wide array of different types of foods, it can be really difficult. So in the case of Arctodecimus, the giant short-faced bear, previous studies have shown that it has really high nitrogen isotopes in some cases. Well, nitrogen isotopes typically are higher if you are if you're sort of higher up in the trophic level, if you're eating more meat. So if you are eating lots of beef, you're going to have a higher nitrogen value than if you are a vegetarian. Now, that all being said, if you eat fish, your values are going to actually be even higher than if you're eating lots of beef. And so we don't know if those high nitrogen values in Arctodes are a result of fish eating, which we know grizzlies eat lots of salmon, or whether it's due to them sort of being the sort of ultimate sort of scavenger, ultimate predator. So there's a lot of different ideas. And one of my favorite ideas, which I actually don't agree with, we've kind of studied it and overturned it, but it's a really fun idea, is that Arctodes was actually doing this thing called kleptoparasitizing. And so let me break that word down a little bit, it means basically they were going up to another animal, let's say a saber-toothed cat, let's say a dire wolf, let's say some other predator on the landscape, an American lion even. And because of their sheer size, we're able to sort of scare off that animal, in which the animal would leave its prey behind. So they were essentially stealing carcasses, right? And so the idea is that their elongated limbs, their elongated arms were allowing them to move long distances, and that they weren't necessarily sort of chasing down or taking down prey, but rather bullying the other predators on the landscape to give up their carcasses, right? And so that's a very fun idea. But when we've actually studied it, what we find is that, you know, whether we've looked at the microscopic wear patterns, whether other researchers have looked at the tooth morphology or the shape of the teeth, it appears that Arctodes might have been sort of more omnivorous, eating a variety of different foods. And this makes a lot of sense because Arctodes and another giant short-faced bear, one known as Arctotherium, which lived primarily in South America, both of these bears actually evolved from this thing called Trimarctos ornatus, which is the spectacle bear. So the bear that lives in sort of South America, often referred to as the Andean bear, it looks like it has actually spectacles it's wearing. This bear is actually eats a very small amount of meat, somewhere between, you know, 5 and 10% of his diet is composed of meat. Everything else is composed of fruit and vegetation. And yet Arctotherium in South America and Arctodes in North America, these giant short-faced bears that evolved that are more closely related to the modern bear, right, than they are to each other, evolved these large sizes. It's sort of very bizarre. You know, was it, you know, that they were able to eat higher on the food chain? Was it they were able to sort of kleptoparasitize things? Was it they were able to, you know, eat a variety of different prey types? Or was it that they were sort of able to eat lots of vegetation? And that's why they were bigger in some regards. And so, you know, one small thing, kind of a fun thing we know is as you get bigger, the bigger you are, the less you require per unit body mass. So if I am an elephant, I require less nutritious food than if I'm a mouse. And so these large bears might have been getting large so that they could eat sort of a variety of different foods. It's also possible that they were large because there were lots of large herbivores on the landscape, large bison and camels and horses and mammoths and mastodons that roamed across North America and also in South America, and that those might have been prey. It's very difficult to actually assess. And so it's really an open debate at this point is what those giant short-faced bears were doing.
So if you take time and effort to study something like a giant short-faced bear way back in time, because these things are extinct, and trying to deduce what they ate and what they could successfully hunt down or steal from other animals, is part of the reason, aside from just kind of curiosity, is part of the reason to try to put together some kind of a map for the future where you're thinking about the evolutionary odds of a Pizzly surviving in the future, given the fact that it's got ancestors that are specialists and the other side of the family were generalists, and you're trying to figure out if they even have a chance?
Yes, absolutely. So many paleontologists will also consider themselves conservation paleobiologists. And what that essentially means is we are often asking and answering questions that are of direct relevance to conservationists, but we use the fossil record to answer those questions. So for example, if, you know, with climate change, we can go out and we can monitor a particular population. Let's say we're going to study bears or jaguars or polar bears in this case, right? And we can go out and we can monitor these polar bears and we can study them for the next 10 years. And if we're really lucky and we have funding, we then might be able to put together a long-term ecological research project, which means that they'll be studied over the next 100 years, right? So I won't study them for 100 years, but subsequent folks will, and we'll take these different measurements and we'll understand how they've changed. That's excellent, and we do need to continue doing that type of work. That being said, we have to wait 5, 10, or 100 years to get a lot of those data. In the case of paleontology, time has already passed. And so in the case of our study on polar bears, we actually looked at another period of rapid warming, a period known as the medieval warm period. And this occurred about 1,000 years ago. And so we were able to look at polar bears over the last century plus, but then going back 1,000 years in time. So essentially getting in our time machine, going back in time and assessing what they were doing and how they were responding to warming in the past. And what we found is that they weren't highly adaptive. They weren't changing their diet during this period of warming. In fact, a polar bear is doing what a polar bear does and has done and continues to do for, you know, millennia, essentially. And so that's able to give us some indication that what a polar bear does today, it will do tomorrow. And it's not necessarily as well suited to sort of adapting to change. Now, in other animals, for example, we study coyotes. We've learned that that is completely different. We've seen coyotes actually change in their size over time, in their diets over time, in response to the extinction of different prey. And so all of these things, we can take this information and sort of apply it to the modern and in a very sort of realistic way. So for example, we assume when we make these sort of models or projections in modern conservation biology, we assume that what an animal does today, an animal will do tomorrow. And that's a great assumption if you're a polar bear. It's a great assumption if you are a tapir. If you know what a tapir is, it's an herbivorous animal that lives in South America. But it's a really bad assumption if you are, say, a coyote or if you are a grizzly bear, for example. They will actually change and adapt and change their diets in dramatic ways. And so understanding this, understanding how animals have responded to changes in the past, gives us incredible insight as to how they may or may not be able to adapt to changes moving forward.
From other animal species, is there any way to kind of generalize and say there's a certain category of animals that might be more adaptive to a new environment? I mean, are there general principles that you can follow and say if an animal has, I don't know, a certain set of characteristics, they're more likely to make it than a hyper specialist?
Yes, absolutely. So One of the periods in time we study is the late Pleistocene, or the last about 2.5 million years. And there was a major extinction event that happened around 10,000 years ago. And it's referred to as the megafaunal extinction, or the large animal extinction. And what we know about that extinction event is that things that could eat smaller animals survived. Things that could not eat smaller animals didn't. And so, you know, even in giant bears, even in, you know, dire wolves, even though these things are fairly generalized in what they do, potentially more so than a polar bear or more so than a saber-toothed cat, these animals, by being so large, require lots of, they require the hunting of larger prey. So they require those larger prey on the landscape. They require the bison and the horses and the camels and, you know, potentially baby mammoths and other things, right? Those need to be on the landscape to sustain populations of saber-toothed cats, to sustain populations of dire wolves or giant short-faced bears potentially. And so when those things go away, only the things that sort of have alternatives, right? So cougars were actually what we call middle-sized predators or mesopredators. They were not the sort of ultimate carnivore of the past. In fact, there were American lions, there were dire wolves, there were saber-toothed cats that were all much bigger than them. And so the cougars were really sort of, you know, able to take over as these apex predators because they can eat a variety of different things. They can effectively hunt a rabbit if they want to. They can also take down deer. They don't have to take down bison or camels or these large prey in order to survive. And so because of that, things that were able to actually adapt and eat the smaller prey that didn't go extinct, so coyotes, cougars, et cetera, they were the ones that have survived. And so what we do know is that the generalists and also those that are more able to adapt to eating a variety of different foods, and also many times the middle-sized predators, those things that can actually go from eating things bigger than them to eating things smaller than them, are actually able to do better if one of those prey sources goes away. And I like to joke, I'd like to see a saber-toothed cat hunt a rabbit, right? Probably not very effectively.
Well, last of all, what do you think the odds are that Pizzlies would reach a critical mass in their population that they'd even stick around for long? I mean, if they're so rare, I would think that and I'm not going to speak scientifically here, but I'm just going to think that the gene pool would thin out over time with reproduction, with mates that are just exclusively grizzlies or exclusively polars. I just don't – I mean, what are the odds that you'd suddenly have a new population of this new creature called a Pizzly?
Well, I think, you know, even just the fact that we have Pizzlies is sort of showing us that we have, you know, evolution in action. And so essentially what you're seeing is these two populations that became separated and had very different ecologies over time became very distinct from one another. That being said, they're able to mate, they're able to produce offspring, and even those offspring are able to mate and produce other offspring. And so what I expect to happen is that aspects of polar bear genetics of their genome will actually become integrated into the polar bears as well. And so there will be aspects, what's called introgression, that's happening between these polar bears and the grizzly bears that happens over time. And so we've seen that in the past. We know that this has actually happened. And there's been genetic studies that have showed polar bear DNA, basically sort of making it into the grizzly bear populations and in many different situations. And the reason why they're coming together is because of climate change. You're having one population that's moving further north, and it's sort of starting to now overlap with the range of polar bears. You have polar bears that are now actually moving further south. So instead of being able to hunt on that sea ice full time, they're actually having to move, or not full time, but largely during, you know, most of their sustenance is on the sea ice. Then they only obtain or sort of stay in the areas where, they overlap with grizzlies on the terrestrial lands at different times. So they're now coming sort of into contact. They're coming in contact at bowhead whale carcasses, and they're now in contact more frequently. And so because of all of this, we would actually expect the number of Pizzlies or Growlers to maybe increase. In some level, you don't get a distinct species of a Growler bear or a Pizzly in form, but you have aspects of that polar bear DNA or these mating events that occur in a higher frequency. And so I do expect there to be increased interactions between these bears. I also do expect there's going to be increased interactions between both of these bears and humans moving forward, because there's now an overlap of each other, of them in each other's ranges. And we are now overlapping the ranges of many of these bears that we weren't doing to quite the same extent previously.
It's a remarkable story, and one that I may not live long enough to have the answers to those questions, but I suppose scientists working in concert will be able to watch this for years to come.
Absolutely.
Larissa DeSantis, a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Learning the story of what Pizzlies or Growlers are from Larissa DeSantis. She's an associate professor of biological sciences at Vanderbilt University. So now we're going to leave grizzlies and polar bears to figure things out for themselves. Coming up next, though, on Constant Wonder, we're going to look at another apex predator species whose genes are being watched very carefully these days. This is an animal caught in the crosshairs of habitat loss and facing a genetic cul-de-sac. But it got a boost from an influx of relatives from out of state. Can you save a species by diluting it? And is that going to be the same species when you're done diluting it? Saving the Florida panther is the story, coming up next on Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. The fight to bring back the Florida panther got a really big boost when school children chose it as the state's official animal. But how do you save an animal whose habitat is disappearing and an animal with inbred genes that are causing trouble? What does it really mean for a species to remain pure? Is a panther always a panther? What if you could save it by creating a hybrid? To get that story, Eric Schultzka of our team spoke with Craig Pittman, who is author of Cat Tail, The Wild Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. Here's part of their conversation.
Prior to the arrival of Europeans, what we now call the Florida panther ranged all over the American South, from Florida up into Tennessee and all the way over to Texas.
So the Texas cougar is
overlapped.
The Texas cougar was part of that same population group prior to the arrival of Europeans.
Well, they overlapped. The Texas cougars are genetically distinct, but they're close cousins. And like I said, their range overlapped, you know, Hernando de Soto and those guys showed up.
The key for me is that there's no problem interbreeding.
There was concern there might be, and also there was some concern about the legality of it.
All right, those are two different issues. So let's talk about the concern on the health and science side of it.
Probably the best explanation I can give is to point to the dusky seaside sparrow. There was a bird in Florida called the dusky seaside sparrow that thrived quite well in Central Florida until Disney arrived and the space program. And the introduction of so much concrete into its habitat wiped out a tremendous amount of places for them to live, and then the population crashed. And suddenly they were an endangered bird, and Florida officials and federal officials said, we have to do something. Let's do captive breeding and see if we can save them. And so they went out to capture what was left, and all that was left at that point were five male birds. So obviously they couldn't do captive breeding of the dusky seaside sparrow. So then the discussion became, well, what if we tried to save them by breeding them with a different type of sparrow? It's theoretically possible to do it, but then they got into the legal issue. And the legal issue...
All right, I want to set the legal issue aside just for right now. But you're saying the dusky sparrow also got hung up on the legalities as well, right?
Yes. And all right. So as a result, they decided not to breed them with a different kind of sparrow, and they let them go extinct.
The five stranded male dusky sparrows, what year were they captured, and what year did this all go down?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I want to say 70s, 1970s.
Okay, so fairly contemporary.
And so, yeah. And the last one died at Disney World.
It died at Disney World. I read that in your book, and I was like, oh, my gosh. I mean, you couldn't script that kind of a demise,
no,
right?
No, that's the great thing about writing Florida stories is that they're just so incredible. And
so Florida man is a real thing, right? Florida man is not just something the rest of us made up.
No, it's absolutely real. Listen, when Florida became a state, the first state flag that flew over our capital actually said, "Let us alone." you could take that as either a wish or a warning.
Okay, so on the dusky sparrow, do we know enough about the science now? Because you keep kind of reverting to the legal issue, which I want to get to, but I want to stay focused on the science. Do we know enough now to know if the dusky sparrow could have been hybrid?
They could have saved it.
They could have saved a hybrid of it. And would the world have been better off if we had saved a hybrid of it rather than just letting it die?
Well, that's sort of a quality decision that people need to make. Is it worth it to save an endangered species by making it technically not an endangered species anymore?
Yeah.
That's sort of what they were looking at. And some might argue that the value of the natural world is important to save no matter how we do it. I like to call it the Jenga theory, where if you pull one species out of the mountain of blocks you have in the ecosystem, the whole thing tumbles down.
Right.
So you know, the dusky seaside sparrow served a role in the ecosystem. It's gone now. So what happened?
I can understand why people feel that way, because I'm kind of picturing, like, if the only way to save a poodle was to breed it with a Labrador, then you wouldn't really have a poodle. You'd have a Labradoodle.
Exactly. So it depends. I guess a lot of it depends on how far afield you want to go with your crossbreeding. So if you can get it as close as you possibly can, and there was a tremendous amount of discussion about this with panthers, whether to do Texas, go with the Texas cougars, or to go with South American pumas, which had a healthier genetic background, but were not likely to have crossbred with them in the past. You know, then they had to make that call. What do we go with? Which one's better?
We're getting ahead of our stories here now, and this is the story that you so artfully construct in the book. So let's go back to what? Give us a
spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler. It's too late. It's too late for a spoiler alert. They did, and in fact, the word that you use while we're here is augmentation. It's genetic augmentation, yes. And they did actually save. Now the real question in a lot of the debate goes back to this kind of like really strange argument that was had among the people trying to save the cat, the Florida panther, about whether genetics was the real problem. And one of the things that you make clear in your book is it was really kind of indisputable that the problem was genetics. I mean, walk us through some of the evidence that genetics was the problem.
Well, the most obvious one was right there. If you looked at a panther, you could see it, where initially when Florida biologists started studying the panther, because initially they thought they were extinct, they thought they were completely gone when the Endangered Species Act was passed, and the World Wildlife Fund had to hire a guy from Texas to come out here and actually figure out if there were still panthers left in Florida. And he found one and figured, based on sign, there were maybe 20 left.
Now, just as an aside, this is McBride, right?
This is Roy McBride, who's one of my favorite characters in the book.
And he actually started his career as a cat killer.
Yes. And ultimately evolved into someone who hated the species he was saving, which were the sheep, and started falling in love with the predators he was tracking because he felt more sympathetic to them.
Yeah.
He liked them better.
And yet he was always throughout his career in this paradoxical situation of trying to save these creatures by literally hounding them.
Yes, exactly. He's full of contradictions. And, you know, he saved an endangered species, but he doesn't believe in the endangered species law. You know?
Right.
He's an interesting guy. So Roy figures there's 20 left. Some things happen I don't want to go into right now, but ultimately, they wind up bringing in a veterinarian to go out with the panther capture team that's going out and putting radio collars on them. So she comes in, and up to that point, the Florida biologists thought that every panther they had seen so far had a kinked tail. The tail actually bent in a 90-degree angle down at the tip, and they thought that was a feature. They thought that was exactly the way panthers were supposed to be, and Melody Roelke, the veterinarian, comes in and says, "Oh my God, that's a genetic defect. What's wrong with you people?"
Yeah.
And they didn't believe it. They didn't believe her. And then they finally got a chance to go into Everglades National Park and catch some panthers. And because of some prior crossbreeding with panthers from a roadside zoo run by bootleggers, Because, you know, this is a Florida story.
You just really can't make all the – this is ridiculous.
No, those panthers had no kink in the tail. And she said, you know, basically, look at that. No kink. That's the way they're supposed to look. This is not a feature.
Now, where did the cats for this accidental roadside freak show, where were they – were they from South America or Texas? Where were they from?
Well, they were all locally bred, but the suspicion is that at some point there had been a South American cat introduced into the population there at the Everglades Wonder Gardens, which is not in the Everglades, in Bonita Springs. and so that freshened up their gene pool, so they had no kink in the tail.
And all it took to freshen up that gene pool really was just a couple of infusions.
Right, exactly. So Melody Roelke comes in. She points out that the kink in the tail is a genetic defect. And then as she's looking for other signs, she starts seeing problems with holes in their heart, what they call atrial septal defects.
Sure.
One kitten, she said, actually sounded like it had a washing machine in its chest.
Oh,
that's
man.
How bad its heart was. The males, a lot of the males, their testicles did not drop.
And you said that
later on.
Basically of 10, at one point, you helped me out with the details here, but of 10 male kittens that were examined, 9 were reproductively infertile.
They were a lot of them were messed up. I mean, it was just so bad.
The ratio of 9 out of 10 for any sample is just like, how can that population survive?
Well, you can see why the expectation was that they would basically go extinct in 20 years if they didn't do something desperate.
Well, but so, this is a key part of your story, that at the same time, she was trying to make the argument that it was all about the genes, but she was getting shouted down.
Right. And so sort of the women in STEM theme is a sort of an understated theme in the book, but it's there that, you know, you had these female scientists, her and Deborah Jansen and later Jane Comiskey, who were trying to point out what was true and correct, and the male scientists weren't listening and didn't want to hear them and thought they were wrong and thought they were shrill and unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And it became very frustrating for them.
And the counter argument was that the real problem was habitat.
Right. Right. And evidence has now shown that that was a long-term problem. But
yeah.
The genetic defects were the short-term and much more imminent problem.
Well, if you have a severely inbred population that can't even reproduce to save its life, then habitat isn't going to save it.
No, exactly.
But on the other hand, you could do all of the breeding program you want, and if you don't have the habitat, then they're just going to get shot and run over anyway.
Right. And so we've had something of a problem with that. I mean, the spoiler alert again, but this desperate last ditch unprecedented experiment that they pull off, we, as opposed to having 20 panthers, we now have about 200. Problem being, the feds were not doing much of anything to save habitat, so we now have a larger population of panthers than ever before, squeezed into a smaller space than ever before.
Let me get the math on this right now. You, at the time that this infusion of genes, this augmentation from the Texas cats occurred, what year was that?
1995.
And now we're talking 25 years later, and already the population has gone from where to where?
It's 10 times what it was in 95.
It is 10 times, isn't it?
20 to about 200. And they've done two checks, very extensive checks of the genetics, and say that so far those genetic problems have not reoccurred, and also that the Texas cougar genes have not overwhelmed the Florida panther genes. In other words, what we have out there are still Florida panthers. They're not some kind of, you know, weird hybrid.
They're Florida panthers who have an odd ancestor. An eccentric ancestor.
Yeah, and hey, who doesn't?
Right, exactly. I mean, if
need the defrock minister, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But the heart murmurs are gone. The kink tail is gone. The reproductive problems are gone.
Right.
And all of this was from an infusion. They brought over how many cats from Texas?
They brought over 8.
And how many survived? How many reproduced? 5 of those.
In 8.
Yeah.
Male cougars.
Yeah.
And of those 8, 5 of them reproduced.
No, they were 8 females, right?
Right, 8 females, and 5 of the 8.
5 of the 8 reproduced, and they kept reproducing, right?
Yeah, but not for very long because of the concern that their genetics would swamp the panther genetics. So at that point, they actually went back out and gave them birth control.
We talked about habitat as being one of the theories. We've talked about augmentation. One of the key moments we haven't talked about was let's pull them out of the wild and try to do a captive breeding program.
Right, and let's pull all of them. That was the initial point.
I know.
To capture every single panther and put them in captive breeding.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. But, I mean, they were in full panic mode at that point because the Florida panther had been picked as the state animal by Florida school children. So if it goes extinct, what a terrible black eye for the state of Florida. Who wants to be responsible for that? So,
all right, tell us that story, because I kind of get the feeling that the Florida school children may have actually saved this species.
They did. They absolutely did. You're right. I'm glad you
– Well, no, I don't think I said it. I think you said it in the book.
Okay. Well, let me back up. So when Roy McBride came here to Florida and found that there were still panthers – the State Game Commission, which we now call the State Wildlife Commission, said, well, we need to figure out where they are and do what we can to protect them. So they picked a guy named Chris Belden, who had never seen a panther before, and made him their official top panther expert. And Chris sent out a public appeal. He said, he gave interviews, he wrote columns, he gave speeches, and said, I'm trying to find panthers. Tell me where you see them. And he got inundated with, of course, bad information from people from all over the state. Hey, I saw a panther in downtown Tampa, headed to a strip club, stuff like that. But the great thing that happened is that every time there was a story about this in a newspaper or a magazine or whatever, there was a picture of a panther that went with it. And the panthers, in pictures, they looked like these sleek, beautiful predators, and people just fell in love with them and said, oh, my God, what a gorgeous animal, because they are. And so as a result, they sort of caught the public's imagination, this whole Where's Waldo search, but for something much more attractive than Waldo. And so when the state education department wanted the state's school children to pick a state animal, the ballot that they sent out said, dolphins, manatees, alligators, and panthers, kind of thrown on there as a last-minute addition to the ballot to round it out. And Florida school children went whole hog for the panthers. It was panthers in a landslide, and it shocked everybody. They just assumed it was going to be the alligator.
Well, of course you would. I mean, Florida alligators, right?
Yeah. Well, and so it went to the Florida legislature that was in 81. In 82, it went to the Florida legislature to ratify it. And a couple of Florida legislators said, no way, we're not picking the panther. Everybody knows the alligator is supposed to be Florida state animal. I think they were University of Florida grads. And the school children went nuts and bombarded them with angry letters saying, how dare you try to overturn the results of our election? We picked the panther. You better vote for the panther. And so ultimately they backed down, and they did pick the panther as the official Florida state animal, which gave it a much higher profile and much more funding for doing research.
Craig Pittman, author of Cat Tale, The Wild Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. He was speaking there with Eric Schultzke. Many songbirds go far beyond what is musically required for claiming territory, for survival, for breeding. Their songs, sometimes so complex, so sophisticated, and go on for so long that they attract the wonder of humans and the attention of predators like owls. Why do these birds do it? Why do birds sing? We're going to explore that question tomorrow here on the show. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.